Welcome to Faith and Family, a radio outreach of Family Life Center International. And now from Greenville, South Carolina, here's your host, Steve Wood.
Hello, this is Steve Wood, and thank you for joining us on Faith and Family. I get to talk about one of my favorite subjects today, and that favorite subject is youth ministry. Even though I haven't been a youth minister in decades, it was really a turning point in my life. And we are talking in this episode today, a second talk on youth ministry in a post-pagan world. And what we mean by that, you basically need to go back to our previous episode, 478, because we wanted to determine the context, the cultural context in which youth ministry is taking place today. And I'd like to share with you two words that changed the course of my life, my family life, my youth ministry, my pastoral ministry as a Protestant pastor. And these two words are still going strong in the Catholic Apostolate Family Life Center, which I head. And it's the reason I have a broadcast entitled Faith and Family. What were those two words? Well, I'll tell you in just a second, but it all began as I was a little nervous but yet excited while sitting in on a teen Sunday school class decades ago. But what was going on, I was about to take responsibility for a Protestant congregation's youth ministry, and this Sunday school class, this teen Sunday school class, was to be the kernel of a youth ministry I wanted to grow. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking perhaps ditching the Sunday school class and moving to a youth ministry on a weeknight. I did find out while I was doing youth ministry in California that a lot of times teenagers like to have their own identity in the type and place and fashion that they meet. So anyhow, that's what I was thinking. So this Sunday school class was being taught by the assistant pastor, and he was going through some key verses in the Epistle to the Hebrews, and he asked the question, who is interceding for us at the right hand of God? Who's interceding for us at the right hand of God? And one young man called out, our mothers. And of course, the entire class just burst out into laughing because they got the joke, since most of these teens came from strong practicing Christian families, and they knew that their mothers were praying for them. But the young man who made the our mother joke had to know about Christ was the one sitting at the right hand of God in order to make a joke about it, that the mothers are interceding. And I realized that he had to come from a good family because he had prayerful parents and he knew it. They had instructed him in the scriptures, because he couldn't have made the joke about that verse from Hebrews if he didn't kind of know the background to it. Now, about this time in my life, I had a growing appreciation for the practice of discipleship. Discipleship, basically from studying the Gospels, was the method that Jesus used to change the world. And I spoke last episode by a type of focus in youth ministry, and I used the term discipleship. In other words, we can continue to have large group youth meetings, pizza and Pepsi, have a great time, and have a religious pep talk, so to speak, and whatever. But I also urged kind of those who want to make a commitment and start doing a little work to deepen their faith, well, then form discipleship groups. Because not only in the first century, but in my estimation, in the 21st century, when our culture is falling apart, culture always affects Christians. As I mentioned last episode, if you want Exhibit A, go to Revelation chapters 2 and 3, the seven churches in Asia Minor. And most of those churches, and they weren't very old churches, including one with St. John living there along with the Blessed Virgin Mary, had strong rebukes from God himself. So the weakness in the culture invades the life of Christians, and young people are particularly vulnerable. So I'm looking to reestablish first century discipleship for 21st century youth ministry. And discipleship is the way that Jesus trained his followers. And so discipleship, and I was understanding that this could be the way I was, this was the 1970s. And about this time, middle school and high school, the counterculture had hit those areas, the drug craze and everything else. So it was quite a wild time. And it was the need for discipleship I was becoming aware of. So as I was sitting there in the back of this Sunday school class, and that young man who told the joke and said, our mothers are the ones interceding for us at the right hand of God, I thought to myself, okay, you're going to be one of my peer leaders that I'm going to try to disciple. And in fact, that young man did become a peer leader. He eventually became a Protestant minister, and the discipleship concept really worked then, and it'll work even more. But what I learned in youth ministry from those two words is I discovered that what was going on at home really impacted what was going on in youth ministry. And I don't want to get into too many specifics, but on the positive side, those who came from good homes and who were willing to kind of go a second step and be discipled, a lot of them became lay leaders, Protestant pastors, Protestant missionaries, and they were peer leaders in the youth group. Not always. But some of the teens who came from turbulent, I'll just use that word, turbulent family backgrounds, for years afterwards, not only while they were teens, but for years afterwards, had a lot of struggles as Christians. And I began to see that it wasn't up to me as the ultimate one in general, because there are those, in fact, one of the men who helped me in youth ministry came from a turbulent background, and God got a hold of him and turned his life around, and he's done very well in life. But generally, it's those who were most responsive to digging deeper, sticking with their Christian faith, were those who came from strong backgrounds. And like the young man who I told you about made the joke about our mothers were the ones interceding for us at the right hand of God, I came to learn also he had a very good and strong Christian father. So mothers and fathers were keys to my trying to make disciples in a youth ministry. And so here it is. This is the secret sauce for a successful youth ministry. And it's very easy to understand, sometimes very difficult to do, which most good things are. But a youth ministry can continue to help grow the good things that were started at home. And you can attempt to minimize the bad influences from a home environment. But the bottom line, the outcome of a good youth ministry is often determined a long time, a really long time, before a teen ever joins a youth group. It begins as a child at home. One of my favorite quotes from the Pope of the family, St. John Paul II, in fact, I have a coffee cup sitting right now on my desk with this statement on it, says, "The future of the world and of the church passes through the family." Now, I really don't think St. John Paul is going to mind about what I'm about to do, but I'm going to add just a little bit to that phrase because we're talking about youth ministry, and this captures it, and I'm going to repeat it. The future of the world of the church and of youth ministry passes through the family. It's really a deception to think that you're going to hire somebody to have a huge bunch of kids that you're going to meet with for an hour or so a week and go on a retreat a couple times a year and forget about the family, and then if you're going to keep these kids strong in their Catholic faith in the future. You know, two-thirds are washing out now. It's probably going to get worse as we go through this decade unless something changes. And I've mentioned this before, but, you know, there's certain things that in your life, kind of like for me, that our mothers, when I started to see that young man had the strong family influence, he became my target, so to speak, for discipleship, and it worked out really, really well. And so it really had influenced everything I've tried to do as an adult in Christian ministry, both as a Protestant and as a Catholic. And there's another one. It's one of those things that kind of like sticks with you. Towards the end of my Protestant seminary experience, I took a kind of a practical ministry class from what was called the most successful evangelical pastor in New England. And just so you know, New England wasn't the best place to try to grow an evangelical church or anywhere. It's a tough environment spiritually. So anyhow, we went down to his church in Lexington, Massachusetts. We drove down. He wanted to hold it right in his church rather than in his seminary classroom. And it was all guys in the class. And we were sitting there. He came in, and he says, "Gentlemen, please follow me." And okay, we were upstairs in a classroom. We walked downstairs to the most well-equipped church nursery, the cleanest. And he explained, you know, the most well-staffed, and there's, you know, rocking chairs next to each crib and all this kind of stuff. And then he said these words, you want to be a minister, this is what you do. His words were these, quote, "Gentlemen, it all starts here," unquote. So I'll take that and apply it to youth ministry. Gentlemen and ladies, it all starts here. In other words, it starts in the family, and it starts a decade and a half, or at least a full decade, before that young person enters a teen group. And there's an additional need. In other words, you just can't concentrate on the kids. That's a huge mistake, because disciples are made by disciplers. There wouldn't be Christian discipleship if there wasn't for Jesus Christ, because he discipled his apostles. How did the apostles train those who followed them? They discipled them. How did Christianity work in a pagan environment? Because the leaders were discipled, who in turn discipled the members of their parishes and congregations. So more than a well-staffed nursery and Sunday school or CCDE program, the key is that the pastors need to teach the parents so that the parents can teach their children. And you say, well, why do you have to do that? You know, we've got great Sunday schools if you're a Protestant, or we have great CCD catechism programs and sacramental preparation programs. Why do we need to do that? Because if you're depending on a third party with no real strong relationship to their students to convey a faith strong enough to survive in the 21st century, I have to say you're dreaming. You might even be I'll just stop there. You're dreaming, because the parents are God's initial disciplers. That's the plan. And this isn't a new plan. Jesus didn't come up with something new, because the Blessed Virgin Mary and Saint Joseph were simply doing what every faithful Jew should do. I mean, Moses said back in the beginning, you know, you're supposed to speak of this stuff to your children while you're in your home, while you're walking in the way, all the time. Parents are. They were the ones that convey it. It wasn't an educational program. Educational programs are great. Youth programs are great, but they are secondary, and you need the primary. And what we've allowed to do is the secondary to displace the primary, and parents are the assumption, as long as I'm doing all the secondary stuff, I'm guaranteed to go. And then they're heartbroken when their teens and later teens or their 20s start walking away from their faith. So it's critical to get the parents involved. Now, I have a little equation here I'm looking at, and it's intended to get some people really ticked at me. And I don't mean to be mean at all. I want to move some folks to action, okay? And the equation is, on the left side of the equation, is drop off Catholicism. Well, what's that? If you as a parent are depending on something that you get your kids in the car, you take them over to church and drop them off for, you know, a CCD class, a catechism class, a youth group, or whatever, that's drop-off Catholicism, okay? And by drop-off Catholicism, I mean that's it. You're simply dropping them off for somebody else to disciple them. That's drop-off Catholicism. Okay, and then my equation, I have the equal sign. Drop-off Catholicism leads to dropping the faith. That, folks, is life in the 21st century. If all you're doing is dropping your kids off for a program, a class, or whatever, and those programs and classes are good and necessary as secondary resources, but if you're not, as a mom and a dad, conveying these things to your children, you are into drop-off Catholicism, and I think you're expecting way too much of the finest youth group if you don't first lay the foundation of faith in your family life. So here it is. And then there's this big challenge that every parent faces. And even parents of real young kids figure this out, that God sends a problem with your kids. I mean, a major problem. There's something terribly wrong with all kids coming into this world. And it's this: they very often don't do what you tell them to do. But they're inevitably will do what you do. Did you hear that? And the idea is imitation. It's not just words, but it's life and words and relationship that causes discipleship. And the origin of youth ministry is the youth ministry that takes place in the home, so that when they come to the parish for youth ministry, it can succeed and get them, you know, those final steps before they launch into a lifelong faith rather than dropping their faith. So how in the world would you disciple someone in the situation? I personally, I don't know, I think most of you would agree with me, our cultural situation is just a total mess. It's so difficult. And if you're a parent of a young child, you're sitting there thinking, how am I going to keep this precious child that God has brought into my life, how am I going to keep that child faithful in the midst of this cultural situation? And I have a ready answer for this, and it's based on two things: my study of the New Testament and being in the United States Navy. I thought I had seen it all on a secular campus. Really thought I had seen it all. It was just unimaginable, you know, going from living at home and going to high school and going off to university to see what goes on the weekends. And I thought I had seen it all. And then I joined the Navy, and you've never seen anything. Just you haven't seen anything until you are in the Navy and enter a foreign port. I can remember vividly going to Haiti, which we should be praying for right now. It's in a mess. But I was on duty, and you probably heard the expression, somebody drank themselves blind. Well, within about two and a half hours of being on duty, there was a petty officer coming down the pier, screaming at the top of his lungs, "I can't see, I can't see." I don't advise anybody to get drunk, but if you're ever going to get drunk, please don't do it in Haiti because of the cheap whiskey. He had literally drank himself blind. The place was just crazy. Okay. In the Old New Testament, St. Paul went to perhaps the worst port city, navy city, sailor city in the Roman Empire. It was a town by the name of Corinth. And it was a place where ships from all over the Mediterranean would come, and they had a little isthmus where they'd take a lot of goods over the isthmus from one ship and then load them into another and such. And it was the wildest port in the Roman Empire. I think they had three temples, all devoted to sex. And on top of the hill in Corinth, if you're sitting in a city, you look up on the hill, the largest temple had 1,000 prostitutes, both male and female. And there were words in the Greek language like to Corinthicize, just basically meant to hook up with a prostitute. There were words built off of the word Corinth. So how could St. Paul, when he went to Corinth, make disciples? He went there, actually, and he was about to leave. And God came to him in the night, said, "Stay here, for I have many people in this city." Now, parents today might think, "I'm just throw up my hands. This is an impossible situation to make faithful Christians in today's world. How in the world would you make a faithful disciple? Not just somebody who's willing to go to church, but I mean get serious about their faith the rest of their life. How in the world would you do that in a place like Corinth?" This is Exhibit A. Exhibit A for parents today, really. And it's, again, exceedingly challenging, yet exceedingly simple. In Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 4, and verse 16, he says this, "I urge you then, be imitators of me." That's discipleship. Be like what I say, but just as important, watch my life, watch my attitudes, watch my priorities, watch my prayer life, watch my devotion and love for God, and just imitate me. Because that's the way you teach the whole person. Our idea of education is just like putting facts in heads and that'll change the whole life. No, it's whole life to whole life. St. Paul said, "Be imitators of me." Okay, he goes in to Corinth. To my knowledge, this is the worst town. And I'm just saying from my experience and seeing foreign ports where sailors are, it's just unbelievable. And yet this is how St. Paul brought sanity. Then he goes to the next verse and pay attention to that. "Therefore, I sent to you Timothy." Timothy was a young man who St. Paul discipled. "Therefore, I sent to you Timothy, my beloved and faithful child." St. Paul was like a father to Timothy, "and my child in the Lord, to remind you of my ways in Christ as I teach them everywhere in every church." This isn't just a formal homily or a catechism lesson or something like that. It was somebody coming. Yes, St. Paul preached. He gave scripture expositions, but just as much he gave his life, and he gave it to Timothy. So St. Paul could send Timothy to the worst town, my knowledge, in the Roman Empire because he had been discipled as a child, as a father and a mother would do with a child, as St. Paul did with Timothy. So Timothy goes to the worst place, the worst cultural environment, and he says, "He will remind you of my ways in Christ as I teach everywhere." That's the way St. Paul taught. And it's different from the way we're going about it today. And he could disciple a Christian in a pagan town while he wasn't there, because he sowed his life, didn't work on the crowd. He worked on focusing on someone like that young man who said, "Our mothers." St. Paul focused on Timothy, and he shared his life with him, not just his thoughts and his words, his whole life, his way of life. And so St. Paul could write to the Corinthians, be imitators of me. Well, how do we know how to do that? Just look at Timothy, because he did that with me. This is how Christianity sticks and doesn't wash out. And it wasn't just in Corinth. In our Luke 21 broadcast, by the way, we're going to have a Luke21.com website coming up this week. But in 1 Thessalonians, chapter 1, verse 6, St. Paul says again, be imitators of us and of the Lord, for you received the word in much affliction so that you became an example to all the believers in Macedonia. That's northern Greece. So what happened? Paul went there. He was there a fairly short time, but they became imitators of Paul, stood up despite the what we would call social pressure. Today, a young person finds peer pressure. It was from the example of Paul that they caught it because they were imitators of Paul, not just students, imitators. This is discipleship. Wasn't just a large group of rah-rah. This was serious discipleship. They stood up the persecution. So, you know, today, don't dare imagine a 50-minute chastity talk on a teen retreat weekend is going to have a lasting effect on your teen without discipleship in today's post-pagan culture. A little later in Paul's letter to the Corinthians, chapter 11 and verse 1, he says what every youth worker who wants to be a disciple maker should say, be imitators of me as I am of Christ. I'm Steve Wood, your host, and you've been listening to episode 479 of Faith and Family.
Faith and Family is a radio outreach of Family Life Center International. Visit us online at dads.org to learn more about Catholic family life.